Welcome to Encounter, abc.net.au/rn. I'm Kerry Stewart, and this week we're starting up the computer and going online to find out what religions are represented there and how their traditions are being changed by the experience. But first, how does virtual reality pioneer Mark Pesce relate to his computer?
We all do invest a lot of our psychic energy into our various computers, whether they're mobiles or they're laptops or desktops or whatever. And we don't really think about the fact that we're investing all this psychic energy in this object. We spend a lot of time focused on it. And my personal feeling is that because this is true, we really should think hard about how to imbue that object with some ability to mirror the fact that we're sacred. You know, I do little things. All of my computers for the last 15 years have always been named after goddesses. But then you can also do things. You can put a nice image that reminds you of that on the desktop. So I just bought an iPad. Well, what do I have is the basic screen when you just turn on the button. It's a lotus flower because that's to remind me of mindfulness.
This bell, which you can program to ring randomly from your computer while you surf the net, is another mindfulness tool. Today we'll hear from a Christian theologian, an Anglican priest whose ministry is in the virtual world of Second Life, and a Zen Buddhist teacher about the positives and the challenges that religious communities face as they increasingly use the internet. So what religious groups have infiltrated the cyber world? Dr. Brenda Brasher is a sociologist working in New Orleans, and she's the author of Give Me That Online Religion.
Every religious group of which I'm aware has a presence on the web. That includes, by the way, the Amish, who have a presence maintained for them on the web. If we try to look at what's happened in the history, the short history of online religion, I think there have been some very interesting changes and developments. Internet use first grew and developed around university settings. And typically when young people go off to university, they're sort of at their least religious. So the first people we saw going online were individuals, small new religions. So we got neo-pagans, really got into it much earlier than organized religion and people associated with organized mainstream religions. They came quite a bit later.
So my name is Mark Pesce, and I'm currently the honorary associate in the Digital Cultures Program at the University of Sydney, but I do a lot of other things. But say 20 years ago, I became completely obsessed with virtual reality, thinking it was going to be the next big thing, and was doing a lot of work on them just about the same time that the World Wide Web came around. And I realized when I looked at the web, I said, wait, I can use that. I can use that as a platform for getting people to experience the same virtual world wherever they happen to be, anywhere on Earth. And I worked with one of my very good friends, Tony Parisi, to create something that's formally called the Virtual Reality Modeling Language, or VRML.
In those very, very early days, you wouldn't have had a sort of a philosophical framework, would you?
Oh.
So did you realize then early on that something was missing?
You know how they say there are no atheists in foxholes? Well, there are no atheists in the virtual world either. And this was the thing that I found out, because I entered my work in VR after the work had been going on formally for 4 or 5 years and was meeting all these people that I really considered the amazing stars in it. And all of them, to a person, had very strong philosophical views. You wouldn't sort of say that they were all of one type, but it certainly seems as though people who have a mystical or religious bent see something in the virtual world. I can't tell you why this is, but I know that it's true because there are simply too many examples of it. This was certainly true in the very first days.
So how does a mainstream theological framework intersect with cyberspace? Jennifer Cobb has spent a large part of her career in the high technology world. She's also a Christian theologian and author of Cyber Grace, The Search for God in the Digital World.
Teilhard de Chardin is a very interesting resource when thinking about cyberspace. He was a French Jesuit, theologian, and paleontologist. And early on in his career, as a very young man, he was in the Gobi Desert in China, and he had a radical mystical experience where he suddenly looked up and saw the entire desert around him infused with life, light. And in that moment, he had one of those life-changing experiences where he said, I believe that everything around me is filled with life. God is radically present. God is radically imminent. He became what is known as a panentheist, that God is radically in the world as well as radically beyond it. And he then took that seed of experience and developed it into a theory of evolution, which I think in many ways is more evocative than really good hard science from our current perspective. But his core insight was that as he looked at his paleontological work, he said what he noticed was that as forms become more complex through evolutionary history, there was an attendant increase in consciousness. So if you look at the most complex organism on the planet, the human brain, that is also where you have the most consciousness. And so he took that a next step and said that the direction of evolution is towards increasing complexity and increasing consciousness. And he put this into a format where he posited these interlocking epochs or layers of evolution. So you start with the physiosphere or the material world. On top of that is layered the biosphere, or the world of life that emerged out of the material world. And then layered on top of the biosphere is what he called the nuosphere. Nuo is Greek for thought. In fact, cyberspace in many ways is an embodiment of this layer of thought that surrounds the world, that we are now actively humans, conscious human beings, are really the guiding edge of evolution. That the center of gravity of evolution now is in consciousness. It's not in the physical evolution of our bodies. That has slowed radically down. And so when you think about that, it really sheds a very different ethical and moral light on cyberspace. It argues that we now are responsible for the trajectory of evolution. And I believe that's a responsibility we need to take very, very seriously. So when we look at cyberspace, I believe we should approach it with a deep reverence for the responsibility that we have in ushering the future forward.
One of the things that fascinates me about the internet and religion is to look at it through the lens of the history of technology. Before the printing press, and this is Christianity as an example, there were biblical texts around, but there weren't that many, and not everyone had all of them. Not even a priest necessarily had all of them. When we get into the advent of the printing press and the way the biblical texts get mass-produced and then kind of explode around the world, suddenly the core text that are grounding this religious tradition were widely available. And as they become widely available and people can be informed then about their religion, then they have a platform upon which they can stand to engage the better educated religious authorities. So the status of lay people, I would say, raises with the advent of the printing press. And I would further suggest that the status of the laity is elevated again with the advent of the internet. It is amazing what you can find online today in terms of any sacred text, history of rituals, practice of rituals, and it's changed the relationship between a typical person and religious authorities. And I think that clearly religious leaders have responded to this. And I've been giving a lot of examples from Christianity, but the same is true in Islam as well, in that you have imams who maintain their own websites and have email addresses where people can write to them and so forth.
throughout time, our understanding, the paradigm through which we see the world is often very similar to the way in which we experience the divine. So, for example, when we were primarily agrarian people, the gods and goddesses were the wind and the rain and the corn and things like that. And then, you know, fast forward and in the Enlightenment, when we lived in an utterly mechanistic world, God was the great transcendent clockmaker above it all, sort of trying to move the world, get it in motion, and then step away. And it's my sense that we're now entering a new paradigm, which is the information paradigm or the cybernetic paradigm. And the question I was bringing to the book was to try and understand how that new paradigm that we're inhabiting was transmuting itself into our experience of faith and the divine. In the world of theology, the science and religion dialogue has advanced quite a lot, but the interesting thing there is that there's a lot of coherence between scientists who think extremely abstractly and in big picture ways, like physicists and theologians. That's been a fairly natural place for those two worlds to come together. Essentially, biologists, physicists, chemists are basically working with a pre-existing world. We were born into an organic world, and they're analyzing and trying to understand that world. Computer scientists are really very different. They are creating a world of their own making. In many ways, computer scientists are gods in their own universes, so it's harder to make that connection sometimes with theologians.
Jennifer Cobb, who's a theologian and author of Cyber Grace. So let's find out about the religious background of one of those early computer scientists who helped create the virtual world, Mark Pesce.
I was raised very suburban Catholic, which in America is, you know, lots of folk masses, and it was all very gentle, and I was confirmed, but it didn't really have any meaning for me. And then I had a very strong sort of classic and almost the William James sense religious conversion experience when I was in my early 20s to Pentecostal Christianity. And that was a profound experience for me, but it was also a profoundly disorienting experience because I'm gay. And so to be that profoundly Christian and to be gay at the same time, it just one of them had to go, and being gay wasn't going to change. So that experience was so intense that for, say, a decade, I consciously didn't pay attention to anything that was religious or mystical because it just hurt too much. The memory of it was, I think, too profound. So by the time I was in my 30s, I think that sense started to come to life in me again, and I became attracted to, I guess, systems of thought. I mean, they're called pagan, they're called Wicca, whatever you want to call it. I don't like any of those because those terms tend to be very heavily weighted, but where it focuses on the connection between the individual and the world. And my practice over the last 17 years now has really been geared around that, about how do you bring yourself into religious, mystical, philosophical balance with the world around you. And the thing is that my work in virtual reality became the mirror for that. And it was also true that a lot of the people who were involved in first-generation virtual reality work were pagans. Very early on, we created a sacred space using VRML, this thing that I invented back in 94, where it could create a collaborative sacred space. And it was done along pagan lines. And it was, you know, maybe the first one that anyone had done using the technology. And the thing that we tried to do was to say, what's in here is a mirror of what's out there. And so when you're uniting the two, the best way to do that is by creating mirrors. Then what you can do is actually show people the divine in themselves, the divine in the world, the divine in each other.
How do you create the mirror? Through ritual?
There are a lot of different techniques for creating the mirror. I don't think there's any just one. I mean, one of them is ritual, and that ritual is the thing that connects what you're doing in your head to what you're doing with your hands. You have to create the space for reflectivity, for being clear in yourself, because, you know, if you're trying to create a mirror, well, mirrors have to be clear. Well, how can you be clear in yourself? What does it take to do that? Well, you have to sort of, you know, clear your thoughts, clear your mind, clear your actions, and work from there.
Well, hey, welcome to Metro Church Online. It's good to have you visiting our website. I'm Gary McDonald, my wife Casey, and
Sri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
This virtual walking tour is comprised of spherical panoramic photographs that place you inside the image as if you were standing in the place where the photo was made. Use your mouse to pan around.
Pencil-thin minarets from which muezzins gave the call to prayer and hemispherical lead-covered domes over the prayer halls became characteristics of Ottoman mosque architecture early on.
We invite you, Lord Jesus, that just as you promised, where two or three are gathered in your name, you will be in their midst.
This selection of websites, a Christian sermon and hymn in Zulu, a Hindu prayer, a walking tour of a mosque, and a visit to a church on the Gold Coast is just a drop in the ocean of what's available online. Research shows that most people who visit religious websites also go to real-life places of worship. So why do they do both? Sociologist and author of Give Me That Online Religion, Dr. Brenda Brasher.
One of the things that I found in studying online religion is that some people are more comfortable online in addressing their religious beliefs or lack thereof than they would be in a face-to-face social gathering. I did a research project studying a conservative evangelical college, and I interviewed a man who had been teaching Bible for like over 30 years, and he had retired. His son was dean of this college and wanted to start an online religious component to the university and couldn't get anybody to do it. So he brought his father back. So this man, you know, he's like in his 70s, comes back and he gets all this help to do the techie part, right? And he teaches Bible course online. And he said in teaching this course for 30 years, he had never been asked the depth of questions that he was asked the year he taught it online. And he thought he connected with his students more profoundly online than he had ever been able to connect with them in the classroom. So I think that for some people, just this ability to connect with, explore, investigate, experience their religious traditions, their spirituality via this communicative medium seems to have a sort of freeing effect.
Let's free ourselves completely from this world and visit the virtual world of Second Life. So, I'm on the front page of Second Life. There are lots of instructions. First of all, there's a tab saying, what is Second Life? A world map. Shopping. I can buy lots of different things. I can buy land. I can find out the communities in Second Life, or I can get help if I have problems. So I might go in and see if there are any communities that I'm interested in, any religious communities. I might just type in church. Let's see what churches there are in Second Life. Welcome to the Alafia Country Church. We're a Bible-based, God-fearing, believing church in the salvation from Jesus Christ. This is Second Life Church of Scientology. The Church of None is intended to give atheists a framework similar to that of a conventional church. Here we are, Epiphany Island, home of the Anglican Cathedral in Second Life. Looks very beautiful. A distinctively Anglican church within Second Life for those who are Anglicans or who share the Anglican heritage, and for those of other denominations who value what we provide. We also welcome those who are exploring the Christian faith.
Well, my name is Mark Brown. I am an Anglican priest who's quite entrepreneurial and enjoys exploring new territories, and yet I'm part of a traditional church, and I live in Western Australia. And I think it's important for the Anglican Church to be online to remain engaged and relevant. So it's not a case of being online because it's a fad or something passing, but to be online because that's where people are, and the core business of church or Anglican church is to be with people, to work with people, and if people are online, that's where I believe the church should be as well.
and your experience online is extensive. So we're going to start with Second Life and the cathedral on Epiphany Island. Can you just describe why you set it up?
My beginnings online was with a virtual world called Second Life. And Second Life is a social network. It's been around for quite a few years. You're represented by an avatar, a character, and you walk around literally a three-dimensional virtual world, and you can interact with people from all over the world, and there's many millions of people involved. And as one does, I went in to explore and discover and learnt that here was all these people from around the world, and the church was hardly present. Certainly my own church wasn't at all. And that was really the beginning. So I could see an opportunity and I thought I'd give it a go.
And what did you offer the community in Second Life?
An experience of church, actually. And I searched and found a small group of Anglicans and I called a meeting and I said, look, why don't we plant a church? And not only did we start a church, it took about 4 or 5 months, but we actually built a virtual cathedral. And it's an extraordinary piece of virtual architecture. It was based on 3 or 4 cathedrals. It won a Build Award, a virtual Build Award, and it was built by a young German student who just stepped up and said, I'll build it for you for free. And then once that was built, then we started offering services.
And what sort of services did you offer? I mean, you couldn't give the Eucharist, could you?
The sort of services we would offer were everything you would get in a normal Anglican church except the Eucharist. Now, that's pretty fundamental. I mean, every Anglican service just about revolves around the Eucharist. So that needs to be said. We didn't offer the Eucharist, but we'd have the scripture read, we'd have prayers, we had some music played, and then I would preach. And literally what that was, if you could imagine, is I would be sitting at my laptop with a headset on, and I would be preaching and they would hear my voice wherever they were in the world. And then after the service, we'd have a time of social get-together.
Certain traditions, the Catholics and the Anglicans or the Episcopalians, do not believe in a virtual communion or giving the Eucharist online. And I think that's really correct. I believe that each domain, the natural world, the cyber world, they have great gifts in their own right, but it's very important for us to sort out what is appropriate where. And I believe that the experience of communion is an embodied experience fundamentally. However, you know, I do believe that there are people who do things in cyberspace that are theologically meaningful and spiritually meaningful to them. Prayer is a good example of something that does make sense in cyberspace. You're in your body, but you are projecting your consciousness into another place. I am personally deeply troubled by the role that cyberspace is playing in furthering the inherited split between the mind and the body that we've struggled with in the West, I think, for several hundred years, if not longer. Certainly in the Christian tradition, there is a thread that would argue in the Judeo-Christian tradition that the body is something that is sinful and mortal and to be transcended and left behind. And I believe that cyberspace is in many ways furthering that. And it goes back to this wish for computers to help us achieve immortality, that we will somehow use this technology to invent things that will make us forever young and beautiful and give us ultimate control over our environment, including our bodies. And I think this is a very dangerous trend because I personally, as a theologian, believe that there's enormous wisdom that comes from living deeply inside of one's body. It's a wisdom that is connected to a very intuitive place. It's connected to the deep rhythms of the earth and the seasons. And so I'm a very big advocate of always trying to bridge the world of the cyber with the real world, with the natural world, with the physical world. To the extent that we start to use social technologies and email and all of these new communications tools really radically, I think it's very important to balance that with seeing people face to face and being with friends and cooking meals together and sitting at the hearth and, you know, really making sure to always come back to your body in a deep way.
Theologian Jennifer Cobb. La, la, la. Yeah. you can take a virtual pilgrimage to a sacred site, immersing yourself in the place through visuals and music and engaging through text. But it's not like visiting the real thing. So has sociologist Dr. Brenda Brasher found that a lack of bodily experience online puts serious limits on people's spiritual experience?
The role of the body and the question that presents in terms of internet use and religion is something that a lot of people are concerned about. And yet, it doesn't seem to be a terrible problem for the huge numbers of people who are in fact using the internet for religious purposes. I mean, you can send email to the Western Wall, you can tweet to the Western Wall and have your prayer put there. I think for many people, they don't have the option of having their body at the Western Wall. Now, if there are some things that you're supposed to do that involve the body, for instance, taking communion, how do you get involved with such sacramental or ritual behavior via an electronic communicative medium? And a lot of different religions have asked this question. I did a participant observation of a virtual Seder where people were gathered from all over the world for a Seder meal, and everyone had their food wherever they were, but then the basic story, the communication, the conviviality was via the internet. And one of the questions that was sent to the presiding rabbi was, well, is this really a Seder? And the rabbi answered, I don't know. Because I think for many religious leaders, there's still a question about the authenticity or the authority of what's happening online. There have been a number of Catholic priests interested in doing confession online because it does seem to be, in some ways, a sort of ideal platform for a confessional relationship. But in fact, the Catholic Church has not to date approved that, and in fact has said, no, you can't do confession online. But there's all kinds of things you can do. I mean, you can do marriages online. You can become a minister online.
Now I'm going into Second Life. Okay. I haven't done that before. Okay. So all can right. You give me any advice? It seems like the options of people that I can choose to look like are much younger than I am
right.
and much more beautiful.
Yeah.
And none of it seems real to me.
Yeah. One of the, I think, seductions of the virtual world is its capability of producing a false image, a false representation. And false representations are useful in the fact that they can allow people to explore sides of themselves that they wouldn't be able to. But I think that there's, if you enter a virtual world where everyone is uniformly beautiful and large-breasted and big-muscled and all of this silly stuff, then it's not authentic. Then it comes back to, well, why are you going into the virtual world? Are you looking for an experience of the authentic, or are you looking for an experience of Hollywood, of plastic surgery? So the idea of being able to conjure yourself up, conjuring yourself up in a virtual world, that's actually a sacred act, and it needs to be approached sacred in a sacred frame. Most of the systems that are on offer, they don't even consider that. They're just like, you know, here, slap these body parts together and you'll look great. You'll look like everyone else there. So it's really heading towards similarity rather than toward meaningful creation.
So I have to create my username and password. And to do that, I have to create an avatar. So my first name, I've decided, is going to be Eve. Seeing I'm the first ABC religious producer to go into Second Life. And then I have to choose a second name. I have to choose one from this list. Eve Ekato, Eve Diderot, Eve Evensong. Eve Evensong. It has sort of a religious ring to it. Now, let's go to identity then, because your avatar, you didn't use your real name. So why begin with an untruth? I mean, did you have to rethink your religious ethics for cyberspace?
When I joined, you could not have your own name. You were only able to choose the names that were presented to you. And I chose Arcanarianthou quite simply because it was, A was the first, and Arianthou was the first surname that came up. And of course, at that stage, I was just exploring. There's very good questions around representation. Perhaps where it really bites is that we had a member of our community saying that they were a priest. They were dressed as a priest. They were describing themselves in the community as a priest. And in fact, had engaged in some semi-priestly duties. And it turned out that not only were they not a priest, but they weren't male. And it was a lay female. And that kind of brought a lot of discussion amongst our leadership. And what we ended up deciding was that if you took a leadership role in the community, you had to declare your gender and you had to declare some of your experiences. And if it got to the point where you were to be recognised by the Anglican Church, then we actually had to have proof, external proof of who you were. One of the things that I took, and I think this is important to say, is I always believed it was me. I wasn't playing or acting. Who you saw was me. Now, how I actually bridged that gap was that underneath Arcanarianthou, I had my real name, the Reverend Mark Brown. And when you went to my profile, which you can do when you click on a character, it had all the personal details there, whereas others, which was their decision, chose to remain anonymous.
It's very hard to define exactly what the sacred is, except that I think that the sacred has this intrinsic quality of producing truthfulness. The sacred is incapable of lying. It's not part of the lie. So it is, I guess, mindful and truthful, and it is anything that instills mindfulness and truthfulness. If we ourselves are flecks of the sparks of the divine, then the sacred represents that capability to be able to produce a reflective awareness of the divine in ourselves. And you have to do that by being truthful. You have to do that by being mindful. I don't think that it's easier to lie online than it is to do it in real life. It is done differently. We have grown accustomed to so many cues that we use to tell truth from fiction when we meet people in the flesh. We're only just getting to learn those cues online. One of the best cues that we're getting, though, interestingly, is that we can tell a lot about people by telling who they know, which is something that's not visible in the real world or not as immediately visible in the real world. But if you go on Facebook, you immediately know who knows this person. And this gives you a bit of a barometer to that quality of being of that person.
Pioneer of the virtual world and futurist, Mark Pesce. On Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn, you're listening to An Encounter about the changing nature of religious expression and practice in cyberspace. I'm connecting via Skype to Mary Yaksh, Zen Buddhist teacher in Nelson, New Zealand, via the internet. Hi, Mary. It's good to see you face-to-face over the Tasman.
Hi, Kerry. Hey, that's great to see you. Not only to see you, but to hear you.
Now, you're very active on the web. So what do you offer your online Zen students?
Well, first of all, it isn't just Zen students that come to my blog, Good Life Zen, because, you know, I have about 8,500 subscribers, and some of those for sure are Zen students, but there are heaps of people who are just interested in a general way in kind of moving gently towards Zen or whatever their idea of Zen is. Well, I offer articles twice a week about themes around about spirituality or self-development, but they all have a Zen twist in them. We offer virtual Zen retreats. And when we first did this, I thought, well, who's going to come to this, you know? But I've been really amazed at the response. One of the last ones, we got 1,400 people joining us for this online Zen retreat. We're reaching people who we wouldn't normally reach, and they are incredibly grateful for that, because lots of people live in places where there are no Zen teachers and where they can't join a group and where they haven't got the possibility of actually meeting up with others and really feeling supported and on a journey together with others.
And so who are these people?
Again, I was really amazed, because my theory was when I first offered these retreats, I thought, oh, well, we'll get a few people from New York and some from Sydney and obviously some of my students from New Zealand. But the range is unbelievable. You know, there are places I've never heard of that people come from. People from Pakistan, people from Trinidad, people from Alaska, China, any place you can think of, including, of course, the big places like London, Paris, New York, and so on. But it's totally and absolutely international.
Centuries ago, the boundaries of community were pretty clear. The question we have today, with widespread internet use, is where is our community? Do we just respond to everything? And the question of where are our moral imperatives? Congregations seem to be responding to this by having different strategies. In other words, they still respond to the local because the local is their geographic base. But lots of congregations now have a sort of image of themselves as having a national platform and even a global platform. And we see in Judaism and Christianity and to some extent in Islam as a real kind of wrestling right now in terms of how an individual congregation sees itself relating to the wider world. It's been amazing to live here post-Katrina and see how religious groups really take on the issue of post-Katrina New Orleans and come down here and try to help. They follow it, they track it through the internet and through the websites and connecting with people, but then they bodily come.
One of the major challenges that the virtual ministry, and not just Second Life, but being church online, the major challenge is jurisdiction. And jurisdiction is the authority. And if I just focus on the Anglican Church for a moment, geography is everything. So a parish priest, that parish has a boundary. And then there's so many parishes in a deanery, and so many deaneries in a diocese, and then the archdiocese, and then the province, and then, of course, the communion is the world. So jurisdiction is very important, and overseeing each of those levels is an authority figure who is licensed, who is given permission by the central governance structure to be the boss over that area, if you will. So the problem, the challenge that the internet presents is it has absolutely no regard or respect for that at all. So in my congregation on Second Life, I remember a few times out of curiosity, I'd say, where are you from? And everyone would be from a different diocese. So not just from a different diocese, but a different country. So the question then is, who has authority? Now, that doesn't mean very much until there's a problem, until something goes wrong. And of course, this is where the authority actually has its important place. Or you want to recognize the ability and talent of one of the members of the community. And that's actually what did happen, is one of the members of my community made it clear that she had a calling to the priesthood. Now, what does she do? Well, there's no jurisdiction. She can't go to some internet diocese. She had to go to her local bishop, and a local bishop took two looks at her and went, you've got to be joking. So I actually proposed rather cheekily that we create a diocese of the internet. That idea hasn't been taken up. It's very radical, but I think at some point that something like that will happen.
Is there a move to rethink and, I don't know, possibly even rewrite Anglican theology and laws to accommodate people's experience of cyberspace?
There is a move to rethink Anglican theology and policy and laws, canons of the church. Very slow move. I don't want to suggest that it's, we'll have it all done and dusted by the end of next year. But certainly through the involvement of the Ecclesiastical Law Society, which is the eminent canonical law body in the communion, through a number of other very eminent theologians and Anglican thinkers. There are meetings and discussions that have been happening for years. In fact, if I can share a little story, the Bishop of Guildford hosted a meeting in Guildford that I went to, and it was the first meeting we had, and the Archbishop of Canterbury's chief legal advisor was in the room. We had a theologian from Oxford, and some really very capable people were in the room. And I remember the Archbishop of Canterbury's chief legal advisor said, the reason I'm here is because this stuff will change our church. And, we need to keep abreast of that. And so I think, in short, your answer to your question of will it change the church, I think it will, but not for a long time.
The Reverend Mark Brown was licensed, in a radical move, to the Anglican ministry in the virtual world of Second Life by the Bishop of Wellington in New Zealand, the Right Reverend Dr. Thomas Brown. The Zen Buddhist community doesn't have a hierarchy like the Anglican Church. So have other Zen teachers accepted Mary Jaksha's work online, or has there been opposition to it?
I have to say, when I first started my blog, and my blog has Zen in its name, Good Life Zen, I did get some flack, not from all Zen teachers, but in my tradition, there was one very traditional teacher who emailed me back and said, Mary, I've seen what you're doing online, and I'm shocked. You're leading people astray. And so, of course, as a good blogger, I suddenly thought, oh, wow, that'll make a great blog post. And so I quoted his saying, of course, without his name, in my next post. And I got tremendous answers from experienced Zen people who said, that's totally wrong. You know, this is a way that we can deepen our experience of Zen, and how great that somebody's actually alive enough to do this. I think there's something really missing in Zen training. And this is something I want to really address. And that is, it's one thing to go to a traditional Zen retreat and be away from ordinary everyday life and immerse yourself into practice. But the missing step is taking that practice and bringing it into life. And that's where a lot of people have difficulties.
Do you think there's a whiff of the monastery in Zen Buddhist training and Zen Buddhist experience?
Yes, there is. And I think ultimately we have to shake that. Because what we've done in the West, we took the Japanese model of Zen, the monastic tradition, and kind of used that in the West in a secular society. And so that doesn't work particularly well. It only works for a certain time. But I think ultimately in 20 years' time, that will go. I mean, I still, in my traditional retreats, I still cling to tradition. But I'm also now opening another way and another way of seeing how we could do this. What we need to really bring Zen into the West are two groups of people. One is the kind of movers. That's myself, you know, where I move the cutting edge forward. But then we also need the real traditionalists who balk at that, because we need to go slowly in order to really not lose what is important.
So what do you predict for the future?
The net will favor organizations that can be disorganized, that can handle their own disempowerment, that can handle handing out power. And so organizations, religions that can deal well with that will thrive in an era of networks. And so, yeah, the future is decentralized. I think that to me already points to the fact that the Protestant denominations will do a lot better, because the Protestant denominations tend to be inherently, particularly most of the sort of evangelical denominations, they tend to be sort of, you know, there's a church here, there's a church there, there's not much of a hierarchy. Whereas you get to things like Mormonism or Catholicism, which have very strict hierarchies, there may be different issues that arise up around that. I mean, we'll see, because the one thing that we know about the Catholic Church is that it's been very adaptive. It's made it through the last 1800 years, and it's changed a lot in that period of time. So it may very well be that the Catholic Church is still growing strong at 2100, but that its organizational structures have changed completely.
Mark Pesce is one of the pioneers of the virtual world and the managing director of Future Street, a technology and strategy consultancy. The Reverend Mark Brown has retired as cyber priest of the cathedral in Second Life. But don't worry, you can still attend services and find community there. So what's he doing now? And what does he see as the future of the Anglican Church?
In my experience of church, there weren't many people coming to church. It was struggling, always asking chest-beating questions about how can we get more people. And to me, through my experience of Second Life, it was very clear that rather than asking that question, we had to ask, well, how do we go where people are? And so I started a Facebook page called The Bible, and really just started trying to encourage people to read the Bible and get involved deeper in their journey, their faith walk.
And you have a lot of people involved, a lot of followers.
Yes, the Bible page has grown rather rapidly, and I'll share the figures, but honestly, it's a bit of a shock. It's present today, it's got 3.5 million followers, and you know, it's putting on about 200,000 to 300,000 a week. In the past, information technology was usually in the Anglican Church and other organisations, is left to a very young person. Now what we need to do is we need to actually say this is a strategic issue for bishops to wrestle with. Now, for that to happen, they need to get their virtual hands dirty. So they need to actually have blogs. They need to be on Facebook. And if we don't fully understand this very major paradigm shift that's affecting the whole world, then the Anglican Church will be left behind, and it'll become a kind of quaint little retirement village experience.
Telephone to glory, all the joy divine. I can feel the current moving on the line. Led by God the Father for his very own. You may talk to Jesus on this royal telephone.
One of my central arguments coming out of my research is that cyborg is actually the best metaphor for the human being today, in that it reflects our integration with technology such that we really aren't who we are apart from it. And because we are people who are integrally connected and interwoven with technology, there's a way in which the religious traditions may speak to part of our experience, but may not speak to our whole experience, to the cyborgian self. And it raises the question of how far can these traditions be stretched into time, and do they actually have limits, whether or not they can respond or should respond or have some way to respond that makes them meaningful and terribly relevant in the present day, is, I think, the big question of our era in terms of religion in the 21st century.
I think cyberspace's capacity to help us grow as spiritual beings is very much dependent on our capacity to bring that intention to it. So if we come to cyberspace with a clear intention to use it as a medium for connection and growth and goodness and beauty, it will help. It gives us another medium, another place for our spirit to express itself. And the more places, the more mediums we have for a spirit to express itself, the greater spirit can become.
That brings us to the end of this encounter about religion in cyberspace. My thanks to all the participants in today's program, technical producer Phil McKellar, and all the computers and networks that went into making this program. If you'd like to hear it again, read a transcript, or find out about some of the websites, go to abc.net.au/rn/encounter. I'm Kerry Stewart, and it's been good to have your virtual company.
The issue of global warming hasn't been front and centre in this election campaign. The only clear policy comes from the Greens, who are pushing a carbon tax. But just how effective would a carbon tax be, and what impact would it have on Australia's industrial competitiveness?
The carbon tax is a much more transparent, it's much more direct, it's much more flexible type of system, and with the completely compromised ETS, I believe it's now turned out the better solution.
That's Rear Vision. You can download this program from the Radio National website.